podcasting technology of normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com. And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today, Monday, April 9th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. We have a fact-filled, jam-packed audio stash for you today, folks. Thanks for everyone's emails about our interview with Tommy Chong on Friday. And don't forget to cast your vote for Normal's daily audio stash up at podcastalley.com. We have links to cast your vote right up on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Today, we're going to hear from Normal's senior policy analyst, Paul Armentano. And later in the program, we're going to get a CelebStoner.com extra with Steve Bloom. In order to fit in all of our Tommy Chong interview Friday, we had to cut a few sections from Steve's CelebStoner.com update. But the stuff we cut was just too juicy not to air, so stay tuned for that extra later in the program. Let's get right into our stash today. First up, we have news from Normal. FDA postpones decision on safety of controversial cannabinoid blocking agent. U.S. regulatory authorities announced that an independent Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, advisory committee will hear testimony in June regarding whether the controversial cannabinoid receptor antagonist, SR-141716A rimonabant, is safe for human consumption. The agency had previously announced that it would decide by April 26, 2007, whether to grant U.S. market approval for rimonabant as a weight loss drug. Neither the FDA nor the drug's manufacturer, Sanofi Aventis Pharmaceuticals, gave a reason for the postponement. Under the FDA's revised timeline, the agency's Endocrinologic and Metabolic Drugs Advisory Committee will hear testimony regarding the drug's safety and efficacy on June 13, 2007. The FDA has previously denied Sanofi Aventis Pharmaceuticals permission to market the drug in the U.S. Rimonabant, marketed under the trade name Acomplia, recently received regulatory approval for sale in Europe as a prescription dietary aid. It is the first cannabinoid antagonist ever to be approved for human consumption. Rimonabant blocks the natural binding of endogenous cannabinoids, as well as exogenous cannabinoids such as delta-9 THC, the psychoactive component of marijuana, to the neuronal CB1 receptors, causing users to lose their appetites. However, because the endocannabinoid receptor system is intricately involved in the regulation of a broad range of primary biological functions, including appetite, body temperature, mood regulation, blood pressure, bone density, reproduction, learning capacity, and motor coordination, some experts are concerned that the long-term use of Rimonabant or similar drugs may eventually contribute to a host of significant adverse health effects. In preclinical trials, newborn mice injected with Rimonabant refuse feeding and often die days after birth. Mice genetically bred to lack the CB1 receptor also suffer from numerous health defects, such as congenitive decline, hypoalgesia, decreased locomotor activity, and increased mortality compared to healthy controls. At least one published case study reports that the daily use of the drug may have triggered neurological symptoms of multiple sclerosis in a volunteer with no known history of the disease. Mental health side effects such as depression are also commonly reported among volunteers administered Rimonabant. In human trials, daily administration of Rimonabant is associated with lower blood sugar levels and weight loss compared to placebo. Sanofi is seeking to market the drug in the U.S. under the trade name Zimulti. For more information, please contact Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst, at area code 202-483-5500. Here on the Audio Stash, we've covered the Acomplia Rimonabant story in depth through interviews with Normal Senior Policy Analyst Paul Armentano. We're going to listen in to two of those interviews today. The first deals directly with the cannabinoid receptor antagonist, and in the second, Paul helps us understand the cannabinoid receptor system in general. For more on cannabinoid receptors, just visit the Audio Stash archive, click on guest interviews, and listen to our fascinating discussion with Dr. Robert Melamede, one of the world's leading researchers in this area. Let's get right into our first segment with Paul today. Paul Armentano is Normal's Senior Policy Analyst, a job that entails writing research and a particular knack for how to read legal or medical information and relay that information to the public. Paul brings Normal and our podcast listeners the best and most significant information regarding the medical uses for cannabis and cannabinoids. There are some new drugs that actually block the cannabinoid receptors in the body, and Paul is here today to help us discover the science going on there. Paul, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Good to be here, Chris.
Paul, you have a great essay due to be published next month on the drug Rimonabant, also known as Acomplia. We've discussed these drugs before and alluded to them in the program, so let's talk about them more in detail. First, tell us about the drug Rimonabant.
Rimonabant or Acomplia, it's been marketed under a couple different names, but essentially what it is a selective cannabinoid antagonist. And what that means is it is an agent that when introduced to the system actually blocks, in this case, the CB1 receptor, so that receptor system cannot be activated by either endogenous cannabinoids, which are those cannabinoids produced by the body, or by exogenous cannabinoids such as THC, which could be introduced to the body when one smokes marijuana.
And Paul, what would be the point of this? Were there people out there who had elevated endogenous cannabinoid levels that needed to be controlled?
Well, in this case, Acomplia, which recently was given regulatory approval in Europe, it was approved as an anti-obesity drug. As many people know, and as you and I have talked about before, the endogenous cannabinoid system and the cannabinoid receptor system is involved in the regulation of a number of biological activities. One of them is appetite. And specifically, there are CB1 receptors in the brain that are involved in controlling our appetites, particularly our cravings for sweet and fatty foods. And this company has discovered that by blocking that specific cannabinoid receptor, people tend to lose their cravings for some of these foods. And in clinical trials of the drug, individuals that were on it did lose weight on average about 14 pounds for the first year, and then by the second year they only lost a couple pounds, and that is what they are marketing the drug before. However, as you and I know, the cannabinoid or the CB1 receptor system is not only involved in the regulation of appetite, but in fact it's involved in the regulation of a number of other biological activities, including mood, bone density, motor coordination, learning, reproduction, and a whole host of other functions. And the concern, of course, is that somebody taking, for instance, Acomplia to try and lose a few vanity pounds could actually be potentially opening themselves up for other potential health dangers that involve these other parts of the body, are these other parts of the human system that are regulated by the endocannabinoid system.
And Paul, in your essay, you cited a pretty scary side effect report from the trials where a woman who had taken cannabinoid receptor blockers for, I believe, 7 months straight developed the symptoms essentially of an MS patient.
Well, there is a case report in the literature where, you are correct, a woman who was in one of these phase 3 clinical trials for Acomplia, she was taking it daily for weight loss, and she did, after about 7 months, develop symptoms that were generally associated with MS. And this woman had no prior history of neurological symptoms before she was involved in this trial, and after they took her off the drug, her symptoms, for the most part, dissipated. So the researchers who were writing this up in the literature, while they could not definitively say her taking the drug brought on these symptoms, they did note that there was this association, and they speculated because the endocannabinoid system seems to play a role in some of these factors, that in fact her taking Acomplia might have played a part in her coming down with these adverse neurological symptoms. Now, I don't want to alarm people tremendously. I do want to state that in fact there were several thousand individuals over the years who had taken this drug in these clinical trials, and this is in fact one single case report. However, I do think it does allude to the potential implications of taking these sort of cannabinoid antagonist drugs long term.
Paul, from what I've seen about Acomplia, people taking it lost under about 20 pounds in a year, so this really doesn't sound like an obesity treatment.
Well, in fact, the marketers of this drug, because it is in fact taking this new and somewhat unknown approach of actually blocking the endogenous cannabinoid receptor system, they often have talked about this drug only being given to people who are grossly overweight and have serious health hazards because of the fact they're overweight. But you're correct. As you noted, in clinical trials, people who took this drug, in fact, only lost on average about 15 or 16 pounds. So the demographic that this company claims their drug should be prescribed to, in fact, really would not benefit greatly from this drug. The other fact that should be noted is that in the clinical trials that have been performed on Rabanaband, the individuals who did lose the weight while taking the drug daily actually gained the weight back when they stopped taking the drug. So it's unclear to me how this drug would be prescribed or whether the manufacturers are assuming that people would simply be taking the drug indefinitely in order to keep the weight off.
So in this attempt to lose weight, people would be altering this essential biological system in their bodies on a daily basis?
It certainly seems like that. And while we cannot necessarily extrapolate from animal studies to humans, it's really worth noting what happens to animals when their endocannabinoid system is altered in ways similar to someone taking Rabanaband. For instance, we know that newborn mice, if they are given Rabanaband, lose their appetite and often die because they refuse feeding. We also know that mice that are genetically bred to be lacking in CB1 receptors We know that when they are born, while they at first appear to be healthy and normal, they very quickly develop many what might be considered to be age-related declines in function, including motor coordination and cognitive declines. And eventually, when compared to normal controls, the mice die a whole lot sooner because they do not have a properly functioning CB1 receptor system. Would the same sort of parallels be found in humans that are taking this drug long term? I don't know the answer to that, but I certainly wouldn't want to chance it at this point simply to lose a few extra pounds.
Paul, so the CB1 receptor, isn't that the one that THC actually binds with and gives humans the scientific terminology here, the euphoric effect?
The CB1 receptors are primarily in the central nervous system, and in fact, THC does bind to those receptors, and in fact, that is the primary reason people experience the high, yes.
Okay, Paul, so here's the big question. If you take a Acomplia or Romanobant and then smoke marijuana, will it not get you high?
You would not get as high. And in fact, there have been clinical studies that have examined just that. They have given people cannabinoid blocking agents or the CB1 blocking agent, and then they have had them smoke marijuana. And what they have found is that both the physical responses that one feels after they smoke marijuana, as well as the euphoric responses one experiences after smoking marijuana, both of those were far more mild in patients that were taking Romanobant. For instance, they noticed that individuals after smoking marijuana, they did not experience the sort of increased heartbeat that particularly cannabis-naive users most often experience just after smoking marijuana. And when these same subjects were asked to rate how high they felt, they responded that they felt much less high after smoking marijuana when they were taking these blocking agents as compared to when they were not. So while it does not seem to eliminate the high completely, it certainly limits it to a great extent.
So could there be other uses for these kinds of drugs outside of appetite suppression, perhaps as part of other cannabinoid therapies where users might want to eat or smoke cannabis to gain the benefit of cannabinoids without the high, without the euphoric effect?
Clearly, they are trying to get FDA approval for the drug in this country, and at one point they were trying to get approval for the drug also as an anti-smoking aid for tobacco smokers, but the FDA actually earlier this year rejected their request for drug approval for that reason. You know, there could be a time and place where individuals who are concerned about their use of marijuana use a drug like this to try and wean themselves from smoking marijuana. And clearly, more specific to your question, there are synthetic drugs that are being developed right now that selectively bind not to the CB1 receptors but to the CB2 receptors, the idea behind that being the development of a therapeutic agent that would stimulate the endocannabinoid system but would not give users the high associated with THC.
So just to recap here, Paul, in the end, this was some incredible research regarding the cannabinoid system. And Romanobant certainly helped us understand more, but it was not a great weight loss drug.
Well, like I said, I'm not an expert on weight loss drugs and don't know how these sort of findings compared to others. My concern is, in fact, that people unknowingly could be taking a drug daily for the long term that is blocking an essential regulatory function in the body. And if the endogenous cannabinoid system were not involved in so many of these primary biological functions that we need to survive, I would be less concerned, but the fact is, knowing that this system is involved in so many functions, like reproduction, like mood, like bone density, such as motor coordination, learning, it just seems to me to be, at this time, I don't believe that there is enough study out there about the safety of blocking this system, particularly as it pertains to a drug that at most would only help people lose a couple vanity pounds.
And Paul, where is this essay going to appear?
Well, the article that you referred to earlier will be published in a Canadian magazine called Heads, I believe in about 30 days or so. If people have further questions, I would encourage them to contact me at the Normal Office.
Next up today, it's very important for us to understand the intricacies of the cannabinoid receptor system in the human body. It's a truly amazing biological system inside of all of us. Paul joins us again with this interview we conducted in October 2006 to help us understand how it works and what the functions of the cannabinoid receptors are. Thanks again for joining us today, Paul. All of this medical research and indeed the effect of cannabis on the body is happening through the cannabinoid receptors. First, what are cannabinoid receptors and where are they in the body?
Well, it's interesting. The first cannabinoid receptors were actually only discovered, early 1990s, I believe, so a little more than 10 years ago. And initially, they were discovered in the central nervous system. But as time has gone on, research has discovered that there's actually different types of cannabinoid receptors, and in fact that they are located throughout the body, not just in the central nervous system, but in fact they are finding cannabinoid receptors that are involved in the regulation of, say, the immune system, of the gastrointestinal system. They're involved in reproduction. So many of the primary functions of biology are actually influenced now by the cannabinoid receptors. So this is a much broader and significant receptor system than initially thought when the first cannabinoid receptors were discovered.
And Paul, these cannabinoid receptors exist in the body already to bind with endogenous cannabinoids or cannabinoids produced naturally in the body.
Right. There are chemicals or molecules in the body known as endogenous cannabinoids that interact with these receptors, and as obviously most people listening know, exogenous cannabinoids such as THC, cannabidiol, and other cannabinoids found in marijuana also interact with these receptors and trigger a reaction.
So, Paul, do all cannabinoids bind with all cannabinoid receptors?
There certainly are, as I noted, different cannabinoid receptors, and they seem to have different functions. For instance, my understanding is that CB1 receptors, which are the receptors primarily found in the central nervous system, when cannabinoids act with those receptors, for instance, the euphoria that people are familiar with from THC is a result of the interaction with that specific receptor, whereas, for instance, CB2 receptors, when cannabinoids bind with those receptors, there are processes then involved in the regulation of the immune system, and there is not psychoactivity associated with the triggering of those receptors.
So all of the medical benefits proven to be associated with cannabis, increased appetite, dealing with incontinence, as well as relief to MS patients, all this comes from exogenous cannabinoids working with those cannabinoid receptors in the body.
Both exogenous and certainly endogenous cannabinoids. There are some experts who have looked at this issue and have theorized that, in fact, people suffering from certain diseases, such as certain gastrointestinal diseases or certain neurological diseases, they've speculated that one of the reasons people are suffering from them is because their internal cannabinoid system or their endogenous cannabinoid system is actually not functioning properly. And that is resulting in people being diagnosed or coming down with some of these diseases that we've discovered cannabinoids may help to moderate, such as fibromyalgia, Crohn's disease, and many others.
Paul, we have long been familiar with the idea that a quote-unquote chemical imbalance in the brain would cause us to treat a person with serotonin or dopamine, enhancing or depleting drugs. How does that brain chemical system compare with this cannabinoid receptor system?
Well, certainly when you look at the functions that the cannabinoid system seems to regulate mood elevation, bone density, appetite, reproduction, motor coordination. This is clearly a vital system to human beings, and this system clearly needs to be functioning properly for the human body, likewise, to be functioning properly. One of the interesting things that have been noted most recently by researchers is when they have done animal testing on mice that are genetically bred to be lacking certain cannabinoid receptors. For instance, they breed certain mice to be lacking the CB1 receptor. What they discover is really rather startling and frightening. For instance, mice that are born without this receptor, generally, while at first when they're born they appear to be healthy and fertile, within weeks they begin demonstrating qualities like lack of motor coordination. They have a decreased sensitivity to pain, and they have decreased appetite, and most startlingly, they die sooner. So, you know, to sort of drive the point home, this is a system that really is involved in the most basic biological functions known to man.
Paul, this is fascinating. The cannabinoid receptor system seems to be so integral to our life. You know, why did it go undiscovered until just recently?
That's a great question, and I hope in the future you may have some guests that have a better understanding of the system and the research that went into discovering the system than me, because it is somewhat shocking to think that it was only 10, 15 years ago where scientists first began to even understand this process. And clearly this is a learning process that is going to take several decades before we have a very good grasp on it. But I do find it somewhat startling to think that until the early 1990s, we as a society really didn't even understand why someone felt quote-unquote high when they consumed marijuana.
Paul Armentano is Normal Senior Policy Analyst and author of the New Normal Report, Emerging Clinical Applications for Cannabis and Cannabinoids. It's available on Normal's website, and we have links to it at normalaudiostash.com. Paul will join us next week on the Audio Stash to discuss cannabinoid receptor antagonists in more detail. On Friday, we had to cut a few things from Steve Bloom's CelebStoner.com update. Juicy, juicy stuff that we didn't want to not air. So today, here's a little CelebStoner.com extra. You know, also up at CelebStoner this week, there's a story alluding to one of the stars of the old series Beverly Hills 90210, Luke Perry. Steve, is Luke Perry dealing pot in California?
Well, you know, this is a, I follow a blind lead. Ben Whittacombe writes a column for the Daily News, the gate crasher here in New York, and I guess I'm a fan of the Daily News. They do a lot of gossip. And so he ran a bland item, which said, which Beverly Hills 90210 alum or alumni is supplementing a moribund acting career with a thriving business as a pot dealer? So when I read that, it's kind of like a little quiz he has at the bottom of his column every day, some blind item like that. And so, and occasionally they're drug-oriented. So I followed it up, and I contacted one of my Hollywood sources. And after, you know, a little back and forth as far as, you know, that person, you know, making some calls, came back and said, you know, that it was Luke Perry as opposed to anybody else on the show. And so I pretty much just ran with that based on that. I didn't have, you know, too many sources. Just one source was enough to say, yes, that's him. He's the guy. So I decided to run with it. And then I followed that up back to Ben Whittacombe, and I said to him, I sent him an email saying, was I right? And he got back to me. He says, I really like your journalistic approach at Celeb Stoner, meaning that, you know, we got it right. So, and also there was a quote I found online from a website, friendsofcannabis.com, that reported in 2001 that Perry had enjoyed the delights of a marijuana cafe in Amsterdam so much that he had to be helped back to the hotel. Hunky American star had one cannabis joint too many at famous greenhouse, coffee house, The Greenhouse, and found himself incapable of talking or moving. Luke just sat on a chair in the corner of a room and could hardly say a word, said somebody there, and the management of the greenhouse had to call the staff of the hotel where he was staying to come over and pick him up. So that's one indicator. And also in Craig X. Rubin's book, 9021 Grow, which is somewhat of a Hollywood tell-all, he mentions Luke Perry as one of the stoners who used to come into his head shop. He's talked about Brad Pitt and others who used to visit and buy bongs and things like that. So I guess it's not too far-fetched to think that Luke Perry is indeed selling marijuana. And plus, it's a lucrative trade in California, always has been, and probably more so than ever.
You also have posted up at CelebStoner.com a highlight from Bill Maher's Real Time this week, and Bill really took it upon himself to highlight marijuana prohibition a bit this week.
Well, I saw that one coming because, you know, I've been following Bill, you know, this season, his fifth season, for the last month or so. He's been doing a lot of, appearances on other people's talk shows, you know, hyping his own program, and then, of course, his own show usually reserves one or two comments per show to something to do with marijuana. And when he was on the Tavis Smiley show back in February, 4 days after Anna Nicole Smith died, you know, Tavis asked him, you know, what he thought the reason was for Anna Nicole's death, and he said, you know, she must have been using pretty heavy drugs, and of course those drugs were prescription drugs. And he went on, you know, to make a comment. He said, when you hear a lobby called Partnership for Drug-Free America, just remember they do not want a drug-free America. They want an America free of drugs that are their competition, marijuana, which never killed anybody. So I guess the lesson is, kids, stick with marijuana. So that was sort of his first comment about Nicole Smith's death, Anna Nicole Smith's death. And now, last week, the report came out that, you know, that she died, you know, due to a cocktail of pharmaceuticals. You know, he decided, you know, it was time to sort of go after that again, and also tie it into the Schaefer Commission, which celebrated its 35th anniversary last week, and that was the commission that called for decriminalization of marijuana back in 1972, and was ignored by Richard Nixon, the president at the time. So you know, Maher, as people know, you know, has this section of his show called New Rules, and it's at the very end, and he usually does about five specific rules a week that are kind of mini editorials, and the last one is always his longest editorial, and this is sort of his most serious comment of the week, and he decided to devote that to a new rule which he called Drugstore Cow, and he was referring to Anna Nicole Smith, and he started by saying that this woman was killed by her doctor, who's a glorified bartender, and then he followed up to say this month marks the 35th anniversary of a famous commission report, you know, and he says that he was, when he was 16 in 1972, he remembered how excited he was when Nixon's much-ballyhooed commission came out and said pot should be legalized. It was a moment of great hope for common sense. Then, just like Bush did last year with the Iraq Study Group, Nixon threw it in the garbage. So then, you know, Maher will be serious and he'll always lighten the point with the jokes. He goes, when are we going to get it that America's most dangerous drugs are the legal ones in our medicine cabinets, while some of the most benign ones are growing under a heat lamp in my dressing room. Everybody laughed at that quite a bit. And then he goes on to say 40% of the U.S. population has tried pot. That's 94 million Americans, or as I call them, my base. Are we all criminals? No, we're not. But it is criminal when a certain person borrows and doesn't return another person's diamond-encrusted bong, Woody. So it's funny, he didn't even name him by last name, and everybody, I guess, in Stoner World knows Woody refers to, and we're not talking Allen, we're talking Harrelson. And then he finished by saying, this week in the American Scientist, they found tobacco and alcohol are far worse than pot, LSD, and ecstasy, which pretty much mirrors my own experiment in this area. The Beatles took LSD and created Sgt. Pepper. Anna Nicole Smith took legal drugs, and she couldn't remember the number for 911. Pretty good doing this Bill Maher shtick, huh? And then he goes, it's about 8:55 here in California. They film the show out there. I guess it's talking about 8:55, 9 o'clock p.m. It's almost time for me to take my medicine. I leave with one request. Will someone please just make a bumper sticker that says, I'm a stoner and I vote? And so he ended it with that. So it was, you know, kind of thrilling to see Maher, you know, go out on the limb even a little bit more. You know, usually it's a one-liner here and a one-liner there, or he's on somebody else's show and he goes, you know, on about marijuana and how it should be legal or how it doesn't kill anyone and that kind of stuff. Here he decided on his own show, you know, to make a big point. And this is probably the one time this season he's going to really get on the soapbox about marijuana. So anybody who is a fan of Mars and hasn't seen it, hopefully you've recorded it, you can go back and check it out. It's really a great moment in real-time history.
Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 420 tomorrow.